scientists cost about $400 million and was several years in the making. Rival North Korea launched its own rocket 4 months ago, but that was widely seen as a disguised missile test. For NPR News, I'm Dua Lee, Psi-Kow-Tow in Seoul.
Greek authorities say at least 150 homes outside Athens have burned in a wildfire that has blazed since late last week. Tens of thousands of people have evacuated, and thousands of acres of scrubby forest land have burned. There are no reports of injuries. Authorities in Greece are trying to learn if the fire was deliberately set. These are the worst since 2007, when destructive blazes killed at least 65 people. Hundreds of firefighters are on the scene. Air tankers are dropping water on the flames, and smoke is blanketing parts of Athens. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. On the Tuesday edition of Live and Local, Scott Schwartz of the University of Illinois Sousa Archives will bring a quintet of players with Civil War-era over-the-shoulder horns. They'll play selections from the Dodsworth Brass Band Journal in advance of their performances at the Urbana Sweet Corn Festival and the Allerton Music Barn Festival. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music and more, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, whose 26th season explores literary and musical themes from opera to Broadway, featuring works from Beethoven to Cole Porter, and opens with a musical homage to William Shakespeare. More information is available at 333-6280.
Good morning. This is Hour 2 of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Diel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. More bug talk in this part of Focus 580, but let's be very clear right here at the beginning. This is not extermination. We did that. Hopefully, we got all those questions answered when Phil Nixon was on the program in the first hour. This is a little different. May Barenbaum is here. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. And when she is on the program, what we do is try to appreciate insects for their many varied forms and just the fact that they're pretty cool and interesting. And so it's a chance to ask general questions about insects, other than I have this bug and I want to get rid of it. That's not her thing. But if you're curious about them, we can give you the opportunity to call in and say, look, I saw this thing and this was what it looked like. Do you think you might be able to tell me what it is? And I have seen her over and over again do that, amazingly enough. There are a couple of things I know that we'll be talking about. There's a story has just been out that involves researchers here at the University of Illinois and perhaps some clues to colony collapse disorder, which we've talked about in the program before. Also, we want to talk about a new book that May has just written, and it's just been published. She said it's you can get it through Amazon. It's not quite in the local bookstores yet. The Earwig's Tale, A Modern Bestiary of Multi-Legged Legend. So we'll talk about that. And, of course, other questions, welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Glad to have you here once again.
Always a pleasure.
Phil says you run the BBC. Were you talking about this new thing involving colony collapse?
Yeah, actually, two shows for BBC. We just some Gene Robinson, who's a colleague here at University of Illinois, and Jay Evans at the USDA lab in Beltsville, and former graduate student Reed Johnson, and I just published a paper and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that kind of provides an explanation for what colony collapse disorder, this mysterious phenomenon that led to the disappearance of about a third of America's bees over the last couple of years, actually might be. So it's kind of big news, I guess.
Well, I don't get it, but then, you know, I'm a pea brain guy, so it's a little bit too much for me. Can you explain this in a way that even I could understand what is you're arguing here?
This is probably the least user-friendly story. I mean, people have, are hoping that the explanation will be, you know, Colonel Mustard in the library with a candlestick kind of thing. You know, it was a disease. It was a pesticide. But what we found actually using this technique called microarray, this is basically it's a glass slide with all 10,000 honeybee genes on the slide, and that lets us look at genetic material from healthy colonies and colony collapse disorder hives and see which genes are turned on and which are turned off. And the pattern of which genes are on or off gives you an indication of what that bee has experienced. So the idea was to see whether certain sets of genes were turned on in colony collapse disorder bees that would point to a cause. For example, if it's a pesticide, we would expect to see the pesticide, the genes that code for pesticide detoxifying enzymes to be turned on. If it were a pathogen or disease organism, we'd expect to see the disease-fighting genes turned on. And it was a long and slow and involved process, and very complicated because bees are extremely sophisticated, very complicated animals. Plus, the way they're managed, their migratory beekeepers will raise bees in California, overwinter them in Florida, deliver them to California. Raise them in Pennsylvania, overwinter them in Florida, deliver them to California for the almond pollination season, ship them up to Montana. So there are all kinds of environments that any individual colony will experience. So we had to winnow through this assortment of 10,000 bees to find a set of genes that were unique to colony collapse disorder. And what we found, we weren't even expecting to find, which also makes the story more complicated. It was actually fragments of a cell structure called the ribosome. And the ribosome is the protein manufacturing center of the cell. It's like the protein factory. So every cell has kind of a headquarters, which is the nucleus. And this is the place where the DNA is. And the DNA sends out the orders to the rest of the cell. You know, so the DNA codes for certain messages, and then when a gene is activated, it sends a signal out of the nucleus, out of the headquarters, into the factory, the ribosome. So the microarray lets us look at that those messages, which ones are activated, which ones are turned off, and what we found was the whole factory had broken down. So it wasn't even in the messages, but the factory, the protein manufacturing centers of the cell, these structures called ribosomes, were falling apart. Which means, in theory, bees can't make proteins to respond to any stress. So what we had then, you know, people keep saying, did you find the smoking gun? We found the bullet hole. So if you find a dead body, it's got a bullet hole, you pretty much know why that body is a dead body. You don't know where the bullet came from. You don't know who fired it. But you know what the cause of death is. So we had to go back and see if we could find that gun and the bullet. And the smoking gun we found also on the microarray, in addition to bee genetic material, we put material that you find in bees that doesn't belong there, like the genetic material of bee disease organisms. So we were able to see whether there are different disease organisms in the collapsed colonies versus the healthy ones. And what we found was a number of that the colony collapse disorder bees had more than their share of a certain group of viruses. They're called picornal-like viruses. Pico means little. RNA is what the viruses are made of. And that kind of set off a light bulb, because the way these viruses work is that they break into the ribosome and take it over. So they break into the factory and basically reprogram the machinery to make viral proteins, not bee proteins. Well, bees apparently then can handle one or two of these viruses. But when the factory keeps getting broken into and reprogrammed to make viral proteins, basically they fall apart. That's kind of what the in simple terms, what took us 2 years to figure out. Mm-hmm. And not so simple, I gather, from the expression on your face. But
yes, but if the other entomologists listening, both of them probably probably understand. Well, let me just ask one other question, because I remember when we were first talking about this, that part of the mystery was that the colonies were just empty, as if all the bees went out and then somehow forgot where they lived and couldn't come back. That's, you know, so it was difficult because you couldn't find dead bodies to do an autopsy on. Would this explain why it would be that the bees would just all leave and maybe they'd die who knows where, but they wouldn't die back in the colony?
Well, actually, I see you have part of the paper here. I was going to show you the picture there. But Yes and no, in a sense. People ask, well, what's a colony collapse disorder hive? Isn't it when all the bees leave? Well, people describe them as leaving overnight. In reality, it's more a gradual process. So, I mean, maybe it takes a week or two, but you can at least, there are always a few bees left. So you can always, and then there's the question, are the ones left because they're the only healthy ones remaining and who are unaffected, or are they actually just in the early stages? So we surveyed colonies in addition to looking at East Coast and West Coast and Central Valley of California, elsewhere in California, historical bees that had been in the freezer before colony collapse disorder was described versus CCD bees. We looked at Illinois bees. There are no cases of CCD in Central Illinois ever reported, so we had this certifiably healthy contemporary set of bees to look at. And ultimately winnowed it down to just a handful of these different genes. Now, then we get into a disagreement. Oh, not a disagreement. My colleague, Gene Robinson, is an expert on genomes and on honeybees. And at least one of the genes that was differently expressed in the collapsing colonies has been associated with memory. But we were looking at gut tissue, not brain tissue. So it's been associated with memory in the brain, not in the gut. So unless you're like working on a gut feeling or you got, you know, it's hard to interpret that. So that's not in the paper. But I'm hoping we can pursue that because I think that's a very good candidate gene to explain why they're not coming home.
Okay. Well, if people have questions on that or other things, you can give us a call. We have one caller here who is ready to go. Mate Barenbaum is our guest. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. And we will take questions on insects. But again, if Phil was here, Phil Nixon was here first hour, we're done with extermination. This is a different show. That's kill the bugs. This is love the bugs. So if you got a love the bugs question, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. That's a nice picture of you and Gene.
No, it's not. It's a terrible
it's
picture.
It's not?
I haven't seen it before.
I was just looking at a story here that came off from the University of Illinois, and there's a picture of May and Gene.
I like the pictures of the bees, though.
Oh, well, okay. Piatt County, here's a caller. It's been patient. Line 4. Hello. Yes.
First of all, I listened to your explanation, and I just want to thank you for your efforts with bees. But the second thing is that I called a long time ago. I have it here in my notes, and you described for me the golden-orbed garden spider.
Oh, yes.
And I forgot to ask at the time. I'm out in the country now, and there are so many now, and they're just fascinating to me. So I wondered, why do they show up now? And what is their function? Are they for insects? And then where do they go in the winter?
Actually,
I never see them in the spring or summer. So,
well,
just wondering.
Every organism has sort of a pattern of of life cycles, and some of them have many generations a year and come out early and persist very until late in the season. Like the cabbage white butterfly is usually a very early in the spring all the way through October. Others are just one shot is all they get. The cicada killers, for example, are very abundant right now because cicadas are abundant. That's all they eat. And so the dog day cicada comes out in August. So does the cicada killer. Now, the golden orb weavers are probably around earlier in the season, but they're much smaller, and their webs are smaller, and they're much less conspicuous. So I actually don't know for certain if they are they have only one generation per year, but I do know that each stage, each developmental stage makes webs, but they're very tiny when they're born. And the reason you notice them is that they're right now is they're very large, and the webs can be like 8 feet across. It's really hard to miss them. So part of it is a conspicuousness issue. They do eat insects. They eat anything that stumbles into their web, basically. So which tends to be insects because their webs are aerial filters. They're not lots of different kinds of spider webs. Some make sort of a sticky, kind of flypapery sort of horizontal web that's close to the ground. That gets running insects. When you make your web way up in the air where people can actually walk into them and get completely grossed out, that tends to catch flying creatures, which are by and large entirely insects, and they're quite good at catching insects. Where they go for the winter, they have no adults. They have no particular ability to withstand Illinois winters, but the eggs are swaddled in silk. They make at the end of the season. They make they lay eggs. The females lay eggs and make a silken a sleeping bag, basically, for the eggs. Silk is a great insulator, and they can withstand the cold temperatures that way.
Okay, and then I hear the cicadas as I speak here. Is there a function also to eat insects?
No, no. Cicadas are plant feeders. They suck the sap of all kinds of, well, mostly trees, young trees. They can cause some damage. They don't really cause damage. There are two types of cicadas. The periodical cicadas come out only once every 13 or 17 years. These are the so-called dog day cicadas. They come out every couple of years. They may take 1 or 2 years to develop. They develop very slowly because they suck the sap of roots.
Oh.
And they suck the what's called xylem sap, sap that comes up from the ground and has just a very trace amounts of nutrients in it. The really rich sap is the sap that comes from the leaves, which are the photosynthesis centers where sugars are made and go to the rest of the tree. But cicadas are pretty unusual in that they feed on the sort of low nutrient kind of sap. They grow very slowly and they come out this time of year. And that singing, all that singing you hear is the males only are trying to attract females.
Oh. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your information.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for your interest.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And when she is here, we say, give us your fun insect questions. Save your extermination questions. We've done that. We've done that for today. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And there are several callers here, and they're all local. So we'll go first to somebody in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Good to hear your voices again.
Thank you.
The May's discussion of hive collapse or colony collapse reminds me of something that I saw just a couple of months ago. I was in a room, looked over, and saw something sort of brownish and moving on the floor, went over, and it turned out to be a bat that was dying of white nose syndrome.
Aww.
And I didn't even know that because it happened before I saw the first reporting on white nose syndrome. But it strikes me that we have colony collapse syndrome, we have the bat populations being decimated. And then of course there are other species collapse problems like frog species all around the world. And I just wonder if May could talk about the relationship amongst these three or more apparent forms of species collapse.
Well, some people would have you think it's the end of days here.
I'll listen offline.
Oh, right, sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for the call.
But it has not escaped people's notice that there are, coral reef communities are collapsing. The white nose syndrome is very sad. It's apparently fungal disease that's wiping out bat communities throughout the eastern U.S. and seems in part to be spread by people who study bats that inadvertently were introducing this pathogen from place to place, cave to cave. I think one factor that has disrupted a lot of connections among organisms is global climate change. Increasing temperatures are contributing to the stress level of a lot of organisms because there's no question that distributional maps have changed, that species that used to live at lower elevations of mountains are now moving up to higher elevations, species that rely on cold temperatures, species that and their latitudinal changes as well as altitudinal changes. Why is this a concern? Well, at least in terms of pollinators, it appears that there may be mismatches resulting from global climate change, where the flowers are not are changing their distributions in a pattern that's different from how their pollinators are changing their pattern. There are some mountaintops, for example, in England that used to house bumblebees, but they're now too warm and the bumblebees are gone from those particular mountains, and the flowers that have a particular structure that need to be visited by bumblebees have no pollinators. So certainly global warming or global changes in global temperatures are affecting distributions. We humans affect distributions, and that's clearly a factor. Varroa mites are the main way that these picornal-like viruses get from bee to bee, and varroa mites were the result of an accidental introduction, probably in association with humans. We travel now all around the world. We transport organisms all around the world, and we're introducing diseases to organisms that have never encountered them before, and that's probably a factor in a lot of these collapses. Another factor is we, it's an old popular one in the environmental community, but we're not very careful with where we dump our garbage. And by garbage, I don't mean just waste materials, which are now diversifying in all kinds of ways, but also biological garbage. People who dump their aquarium fish, you know, outside or flush them down the toilet end up introducing all kinds of tropical organisms that don't belong, or other organisms that don't belong where they ultimately end up, and cause all kinds of problems. Lionfish off the coast of Florida are wreaking havoc with a lot of coral reef communities because they're incredibly effective predators. The rusty, I think it's called the rusty crayfish. There's a new crayfish in the Midwest that is causing major disruption to aquatic food webs in this area. And insect, there are invasive, so-called invasive species all over the place. I have a colleague who studies Argentine ants transported all over the world, sometimes called tramp ants, because they accompany people wherever they go. And ants are so integral to so many different food webs that the presence of Argentine ants, they don't bite you, they don't sting, they don't appear to be aggressive and dangerous like fire ants. But what they do is they displace a lot of native species. So organisms that depend on ants to get their seeds moved around, they end up in trouble. Organisms that depend on ants to eat don't like Argentine ants, and they end up in trouble. So hard to – I mean, there's not one single thing, but we have so profoundly altered this our biosphere that all kinds of very delicate relationships are in jeopardy.
Just for a second, and we'll go back to calls for a second. I want to come back to colony collapse disorder and see if I get this. Now, so what you're saying is that what you've done is you've looked at the bees in the colonies where you've seemed to have it, and you find something at the genetic level that means that the bees' mechanism for manufacturing proteins is not working properly. And so you have an individual that's not at peak of health. And there's no way that the bee can go around in the world without being exposed to a number of challenges. There is some pesticides. I'm sure that there's bacteria that might affect them. There's viruses that affect them. There are other insects that prey on the bees that if the bee was completely healthy, well, you know, maybe they could deal with that. But the more challenges like that the individual is exposed to, and if you have an individual that's not at the peak of health to fight it off, then you're going to be set up for a problem. And I suppose anything can come along, like the varroa mite can come along. And if you have enough of that, that could, in an individual that wasn't at peak health and can fight it off, anything could tip it. Mm-hmm. So that could mean that you might indeed have more than one cause. But then you don't have any idea, though, what's going on with the bee genes that's affecting the protein building mechanism.
We think it's the fact that bees that have multiple picornal-like virus infections, the picornal-like viruses work by attacking the ribosome.
So ultimately what you're proposing is that this is indeed a virus problem.
A multiple virus, not a single virus. Okay. But if you have multiple viruses, basically the ribosome wears out. When it wears out, then, as you say, the bees are vulnerable to just about any kind of stress. Using this, you know, people are saying, have you found the smoking gun? We found the bullet hole. So you can survive being shot by a bullet, but not if someone's kicking you in the head. That's kind of the – so that, you know, the multiple virus infections compromise the ribosome, and then whatever else comes along ends up causing problems.
Okay. Now I got you. So then is the way to get at that either by antivirals to try to do that, or do you try to find some way to breed individuals that somehow are – either resistant or maybe you can't even do that.
You can breed for resistance to varroa mites, and that's really important because the varroa mites are the carriers of these viruses. And in fact, there are bees that are varroa mite resistant. They just haven't been commercialized and they're not available. But Marla Spivak at the University of Minnesota has used artificial selection and come up with a strain of bees. They're called hygienic bees because they're very good at grooming and they get rid of the mites when the mites are on their bodies. Hmm. And they're therefore less likely to have mites, this therefore less likely to have multiple viral infections, therefore less likely, according to our construction of events, to experience colony collapse disorder.
Hmm. All right. Okay. Let's talk with some other folks here. Go to Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Hi, I've got two questions. The first one is about bumblebees. For several weeks, I had mostly bumblebees, which I think maybe were Bimeticulitis and Fervidus and Pennsylvanicus. And that was when these are all feeding on prairie plants.
Uh-huh.
And it was mostly sunflowers and coneflowers and that. And those flowers have gone away, and now I've got my prairie clover and blazing star blooming. And now all I've got is this bumblebee that's all yellow on its abdomen. There are no black bands, just thin black stripes between the yellow segments. And I can't find that on Bee Spotter.
Oh, yeah? I was going to say, check BeeSpotter. BeeSpotter is a website that we run at the University of Illinois. It has some sort of user-friendly, color-guided keys for the bumblebees.
Yeah, I didn't find any that were all yellow.
Well, I would send a note. We have our official two people. Terry Harrison is our official identifier for the BeeSpotter site, and we have Sydney Cameron in our department, who is involved in bumblebee conservation. She is a world authority on the classification of bumblebees.
Okay.
One of the problems with this color-guided key is that every species of bumblebee, there's 49 species of bumblebees in North America, every species has geographic variation,
mm-hmm.
and almost every species has gender variation, so males and females look different.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Grisiocolis. Have you looked at the pictures of Grisiocolis? That's a very yellow bumblebee, but there is some, I think you can maybe see a little, it kind of has like a ball, looks like a bald patch on its thorax. But mm-hmm. If it doesn't match that picture, I'd just send a note to upload the image. Do you have a photo of it? No?
I finally got some yesterday. The first couple of weeks they were around, I didn't get any pictures. I finally did yesterday.
Excellent. So by all means, upload it. You mentioned you saw Pennsylvanicus. That's actually a bee that's in trouble.
I think that's what it was. I've got pictures. It's been a couple of weeks. It seems odd that the other two or three species that were around when the other flowers were blooming are gone now, but they were also feeding on the white clover in the yard, in the lawn. And now all I've got is this all yellow one. Since the prairie clover and the elytras.
Well, by all means, upload it. And if you did find Pennsylvanicus, that's very good news because
like 3 days a couple weeks ago where I was taking pictures for a half hour or so at a time. I probably got well over 100 pictures
of
bumblebees to look through and try to sort them out. looking at them closely with the key. But
I just have to say, I am so in awe of our citizen scientists because I cannot take a decent picture of a bumblebee to save my life. Well, I mean, here I am. So I think I've uploaded one picture of a bumblebee because everything else was too fuzzy, and not because bumblebees are fuzzy, because my photography is not too good. So I encourage you by all means, because we're watching these reports as they come in. And one of our bee spotters has found another population of Bombus affinis, the rusty patch bumblebee, which was supposed to be extinct in this area. So people, we have a number of eyes out looking. We're finding bees that have been in trouble for a long time, and particularly in the eastern part. Well, there are four bumblebees across the nation that are really, their status is quite uncertain. It's quite tenuous. So Pennsylvanicus, I know, has had problems in Illinois. So
I haven't actually downloaded my pictures from the camera and looked at them on the big screen yet. But. Okay.
Well, that's great. That's excellent. Keep up the good work.
And the other question, so I could email them to Terry Harrison or to who? What was the other person?
Or you can upload them to the website.
Okay. All right.
And that way Terry will take a look at them and he can do a definitive identification.
And the other somewhat interesting observation was with aphids. I've got some swamp milkweed, and I've got gold aphids on it.
That's probably Aphis nerii. This is an aphid that feeds only on plants in the milkweed family, the Asclepiadaceae.
Fortunately, my milkweeds are like 3 feet apart, and they're only killing one of the two small milkweeds.
Good. Well, see, I guess entomologists are happier about finding aphids in the garden than gardeners are. It's a very interesting insect because if you notice, monarchs feed on milkweeds. They're brightly colored.
And that's another interesting thing. The monarchs are on the milkweed that has the aphids, but they're not on the one that doesn't have the aphids. I don't know if that's related. It's just an observation.
I don't know. I mean, if you have ladybugs on those the aphid-containing plants, that makes some sense. But I'm not sure of an association between the monarchs and the milkweed aphids.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the milkweed aphids, just like the brightly colored beetles that feed on milkweeds, like the milkweed beetle, the brightly colored milkweed caterpillars.
Mm-hmm.
The aphids are brightly colored because they store the cardiac glycosides, the poisons that are in milkweeds, in their bodies. So they're actually, don't eat them. They're poisonous. You can fight the impulse to eat those aphids. But
And on my tall goldenrod, which hasn't started blooming yet, I've had bright red aphids.
Yes, that's Eurolucan. There are two species of bright red aphids that live on goldenrod. Also, very beautiful aphids. If you like aphids,
there's a few black aphids on those also.
Mm-hmm. Though that might be another. I think it might be a Eurolucan. We have a student who actually was studying these aphids in the genus Eurolucan. They are also, nobody's really investigated, but the odds are very good they are bright red because they are storing toxins that come from the host plants.
Okay. They were all over the tall goldenrod, but not on the showy goldenrod. Didn't touch it.
They can be quite specific, actually. So that's an interesting observation. But the bright red, that's diagnostic for Eurolucan.
Okay. And one more bee question. I had a black bee that was hanging out for a long time too, and it had yellow on its legs. The rest of the body was black, but it had yellow on its legs. And I was wondering if that was just pollen pouches.
That could be. Sometimes, in fact, I just heard a lecture on hummingbirds this past Sunday at our pollinatarium, and Mike Ward, who's a bird, an ornithologist, said that people will often report to him strange-looking hummingbirds that have yellow on their forehead, and it's pollen, it's not feathers. So same thing can happen with bees.
I've seen some bees with the pollen-covered faces also.
Yes, exactly.
And I've seen a lot of dragonflies away from water hanging out around my prairie plants, actually, red dragonflies.
They may be hunting for prey.
There's plenty there.
Yeah.
And spider, are you familiar at all with jumping spiders?
I know a little bit. I
saw one in my prairie plants that I hadn't ever seen before, and it had its abdomen. It had red on the outside and a stripe down the middle.
Yeah, that one I could get it to the family level, the jumping spiders. Mm-hmm. The most common one is it's called Phidippus. It's black and white, and it's supposed to make you think it's actually mimicked by some fruit flies, tufritid flies that want you to think that they're the jumping spider. But in terms of identifying spiders, they're not insects, not my department.
Yeah. We have about I hope the call will forgive me for jumping in. We got about 20 minutes left here. We got some other people who want to get in and also invite to questions for our guest, May Barenbaum. She's chair of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and every once in a while she's here on the show. And we talk about how cool they are. We save the extermination questions for somebody else, but that's what we do when May is here. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Another champagne person is next. This is line four. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
This is a very old question because this happened when I was quite young, but I'm not quite sure what year, maybe 1968 or 69. I was in the garden or someplace in the yard, and I dug up something which I instantly recognized as a pupa, some sort of dormant version of a bug. And I had no idea what it was. It was really, really big, like maybe over 2 inches long, and it had, you know, those wrapped around wings looking thing, but all glazed over and brown and a little pointy rear end. And I kept that in a jar till at least 1972 when I moved off to college and decided I decided it really must be dead. So I tried to open it up. But then when I opened it up with a little kid science kit scalpel, I realized this creature is alive, was alive, and now he's not going to open up. What could it have been?
Well, actually, the fact that you could see features, you could see wings wrapped around, really narrows it down, because some pupae are pretty much indistinguishable. Could you actually see, like, head, thorax, abdomen, or did it just look brown?
It wasn't a long time ago, but it wasn't, you know, it felt like, I mean, my memory is that it had, you know, lots of contours identifying the different body parts.
Because there are different types of pupae. Some pupae, like the pupae of hymenopterans, like bees, ants, and wasps, you can actually see it's a bee or an ant or a wasp, only it looks mummified, basically. And 2 inches is pushing the limits of hymenoptera in North America, but cicada killers would potentially be about that size. If it was pointy at the end and it looked more just sort of like a capsule with kind of a hanger loop at the top, that could have been one of the sphingid moths. That
I think there was a hook. Well, I don't know. Now that you've said it, I can remember it clearly. I didn't remember a hook loop at the top until you said the words. Like I said, it's an old memory now.
Mm-hmm. Well, if in fact that actually that loopy thing is the mouth parts, and you can see the pupa, actually, you can of a moth has fewer features than that of a bee, ant, or wasp, but you can see segments of abdomen. You can see what will be the wings. And the sphingid moths, like the hawk moths, will, as pupae, form their pupae in the underground. And moth pupae can be quite long-lived in the ground in the pupal stages. The record, I think, is about 18 years. A biologist named Jerry Powell had some moth pupae. He carted around with him for 18 years before they ultimately came out. They were yucca moths, not sphingid moths, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. Did you have tomatoes in your garden or any?
No idea. Probably there were some tomatoes in the yard somewhere, yeah.
Because that could very well have been the pupa of a tobacco hornworm or tomato hornworm, which is about 2 inches and certainly would attract attention.
All right. Well, I thank you very much. I kind of thought it was going to be a cicada, but then it just didn't look like the cicada shells that I see around, much bigger. And
yeah, cicadas don't pupate.
Rounded at the bottom.
Yeah, cicadas have what's called incomplete metamorphosis. They don't ever form a pupa.
Right. They've always got legs, at least in the shell stage.
Yep.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
I'll go on here. White Heath next. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm just calling about ground bees. Have you ever heard of a ground bee?
Well, there are a lot of bees that nest in the ground. I never heard of anything called just ground bee per se.
Oh, okay. Well, they're very small bees. Very small. But you don't know.
Well, there are.
Do they make honey and put it in their hive in there? Or?
Most of the ground bees are what are called solitary bees. That they don't live in societies like big colonies like honeybees or bumblebees. But the female will dig out a nest and provision the nest with, depending on the species of bee, balls of pollen and. So they don't make honey. They usually feed on pollen. So there are bees called alkali bees that nest in the ground. Some of the sweat bees are called halictids, nest in the ground. They're called colletted bees. They're called plasterer bees. Sometimes live in the ground. So there are all kinds of bees that live in the ground. But
well, I just got bit by one about a week or so ago from when I was mowing. And there was a small hole, and one of them came out and bit me.
Or stung you.
Or stung me, yeah. I mean. And it was really, I got really bad reaction. And I thought, I didn't know what it, you know, I think it was a bee.
It was probably actually, this time of year, it was probably a yellow jacket.
It was very small.
Yeah. Well, you know, oddly enough, yesterday, or this morning, a very small yellow jacket walked into my office in a vial carried by one of a secretary in another department who didn't believe it could be a bee. Didn't believe it could be a yellow jacket because it was so small. But it was, in fact, a yellow jacket.
Do they sometimes live in the ground then?
They always live in the ground.
Oh, they always live in the ground. Okay.
So two things. The fact that it was from the ground. Three things. It lives in the ground. It's August. That's when yellow jackets are quite active. And the fact that it stung you, that's very typical for yellow jackets, not typical for bees.
Oh, okay. A yellow jacket is different than a bee. Then.
Yellow jacket's a wasp.
Oh, it's a wasp.
Yeah. Happens to be yellow and black, but it's a wasp. And wasps are not, I mean, bees are way less likely to sting you. This time of year, the wasps do have these colonies, these elaborate colonies, but they don't last through the winter like a honeybee colony does.
Oh, I see.
So this time of year, their whole society is falling apart. Everybody's irritable. They're all, you know, out for each for themselves, and they're likely to sting you.
Oh,
and it hurts like crazy when they sting
you. Oh, yes. I had terrible reaction for several days.
So. Probably a yellow jacket.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a bee, but I didn't know. And you couldn't really see them because they're so... I mean, you didn't want to get too close.
Right. Well, you're not alone. A lot of people think those are bees. Poor bees get a bad rap.
I guess. Well, okay, thanks.
All right, thanks. And wasps can sting you more than once.
Exactly
bees
right.
will not do that, right? Okay. Let's see if we can get a few more calls here. What do we got next? Belgium, line number two right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
And good morning to you both. First, an observation upon what you were talking about, colony collapse. That seems like it's very much like HIV in human beings, in that it's an agent that, you know, modifies itself to attack ourselves, you know, it's sort of strange. But the other actual question I had, if that wasn't a question, is the Luna moth completely eradicated or... extinct, I guess, would be a better word, here in the Midwest?
Oh, no.
I very rarely see them anymore at all.
People rarely see them. They used to be way more common, but there have been actually an increasing number of sightings. What's thought to have happened to the so-called giant silk moths in that family, not just Lunas, but Cecropias, emperor moths, all the big, beautiful, flashy moths. Back in the early part of the 20th century, parasitic fly was introduced to try to control the gypsy moth. And unfortunately, this parasitic fly attacks some 300 species of insects, including giant silk moths. And in Massachusetts, investigators have found that the giant silk moths are particularly vulnerable to this parasitic fly. And it's thought that this deliberate release accidentally ended up knocking back the numbers of the giant silk moths. That, along with a loss of a lot of their habitat, some of the deforestation and the like. But so they're way less common. You're absolutely right. But they're not gone. I've actually seen one within this past season. So they are a real treat to see. I just wish they were more abundant.
And my thoughts about HIV and colony collapse.
With the caveat that we're not dealing with an immune system in the honeybee. They don't have the immune system. You know, what HIV does is makes people vulnerable to opportunistic infections because the immune system is compromised. Honeybees don't have the same sort of immune system, but it is a physiological problem that leaves bees vulnerable to others. So in that sense, it is like HIV.
Thank you.
All right. St. Charles is next. Line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Is there a caller there in St. Charles? Line 4?
Good morning.
Yes,
yeah,
go ahead.
I was wondering, I had a hard time getting a beekeeper. I had those bumblebees, the black ones with the yellow stripe on their belly.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a hive up in my doghouse. And so I took them out. It wasn't very big, but it was, you know, it was probably about the size of a football. And they're wrapped up in that, like cloth. It looked like cloth, like a, you know, fuzz or something. So I took them out, and I didn't dispose of them. I put them in the forest preserve not too far away from here. I put them in the middle of the woods, so
that's
it wouldn't affect anybody. But I couldn't get the amazing thing is, no matter who I called, nobody would come out and get them.
Well, bumblebee, those were probably bumblebees, and they're not sort of commercially useful. So a beekeeper might come and capture a honeybee swarm because then there's our honey producing. But we do have people at University of Illinois who are studying bumblebees. So there may be a network of people who are out to help the bumblebees to rescue them. But yeah.
I hope they call the station and say, because I'd really like to get a hold of them. I know there's a lack of them this year, but I was really amazed at how much inaction I got from anybody. Nobody, you know, I left phone numbers and phone. At least they could tell you, you know, where to go. Nobody, you know, nobody would send me in the right direction. So, you know, I start kind of wondering about all these so-called, you know, the lack of bumblebees and the lack of bees in general, because where are they getting the information if nobody's cooperating? And I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
Well, actually, that's Sydney Cameron is this bumblebee expert, and she is involved in a bee conservation project that specifically is mapping the localities of those 11 or 12 species of bumblebees in Illinois. She's actually going through the entire Midwest. But she's just one person, so it's a massive job.
One more person here, cell phone caller, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question about monarch butterflies and the caterpillars. We have a prairie patch in our yard, and every year we get about 3 or 4 caterpillars, but then they disappear. And I thought they were like poisonous or something, and nobody would eat them. Is there any way to protect them at some point?
Well, are you sure they're not going off to pupate?
Well, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen those. We had one year, and then it disappeared. So,
well, because
my wife's really upset. She wants to.
Well, they do have their enemies. Not many birds, but some birds actually have developed ways of handling the caterpillars, particularly if they're feeding on plants that aren't particularly rich in these poisons, these cardiac glycosides.
Yeah.
Life is not easy.
The milkweed or the regular milkweed.
The early stage caterpillars are actually eaten by the multicolored Asian ladybug, which is a noxious pest that was actually deliberately released as a biocontrol agent some 30 years ago that now has turned around and eats anything that's sort of soft and vulnerable, and it will eat small monarch caterpillars. So.
Yeah, these are good-sized ones that we see.
Well, it's a tough world for an insect. So.
Yeah, but there's nothing we can do to protect them in any way?
Well, the only thing, if you want to cage them, you know, you can get, like, bridal veil and material and kind of bag them that will keep most of the predators out. But then you don't get to watch them. So.
All right. Well, Well, thank you very much.
Right. Well, thank you, everybody, for caring about the insects. This is great.
We got a couple minutes left here, and I want to make sure, as we said we would, we talk about The Earwig's Tale. This is May's new book that will be in bookstores soon. And I guess my understanding is that you say in the beginning here that, you know, of all of the wacky things people are willing to believe about nature and the natural world, some of the most wackiest things that people believe have to do with insects. And there are these stories that people tell about insects and what they do and how they interact with humans that just aren't true, but people love these stories, and you have some of them in here. And I think maybe it was the last time we were here, someone called in and asked a question about what turned out to be an earwig.
Yes, the brain-boring earwig.
The brain-boring earwig.
It's an alphabetical listing, just like an old medieval bestiary. And it's these venerable legends, urban legends, that are just regular legends that no matter what you say, people continue to believe. Earwigs do not bore through your brain. I mean, finding an earwig in your ear is incredibly unlikely. The aerodynamically unstable bumblebee, you know, bumblebees can't fly by the rules of physics. Well, no, that's actually not true. Some of the most dearly held facts that people know about insects aren't facts at all. So that's the point of the book, and it's supposed to be done in a humorous way. The illustrations are fabulous. They're in the style of a medieval bestiary done by Jay Hostler, who's a brilliant artist who actually is responsible for the graphic novel called Clan Apis, all about honeybees. And it's just 26 of the most persistent myths and legends about insects.
Including the thing about how bumblebees can't fly and about how if there's a nuclear war, the only thing that's going to survive is the cockroach and
the deadly daddy long legs, the most which yeah. Somehow made it all the way to Australia. These notions are probably cosmopolitan by now.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now, and you said that if you like shopping at Amazon, you can get it from them. If you'd like to shop at a local bookstore, I don't know, do we have any locally independently owned bookstores anymore? It should be coming out officially sometime next month?
Yep.
Okay. And what's the publisher? Harvard University Press. Well, Harvard University, The Earwig's Tale, A Modern Bestiary of Multi-Legged Legends by our guest, May Barenbaum, to be published soon by the Harvard University Press. Suitable for gift-giving.
And great for gifts, yes.
If you like bugs, you can get that and read it, and look for some of her other books too. All the, you know, 99 gnats, nits, nibblers, 99 more mites, munchers, and
maggots.
Published by, those are both UI Press books, right? And some of her others are out there too.
Right. Thank you.
May Barenbaum, she's head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. And every once in a while, she is here, and we talk about bugs. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Just a reminder that if you're interested in going back and hearing some programs that you might have missed, or maybe there's something that you would like to give another listen to, all of our local production programs that we do here on Focus 580, the afternoon magazine, our news, it's all on our website. In fact, you can even listen that way, listen through your computer if you like. And you just go to the website, which is will.illinois.edu, and it will tell you everything you need to know about listening online. You can go look at our archives, and there's a lot of good stuff there for you, and it's there whenever you're ready. So if you haven't checked out our website lately, we're always trying to improve it and take a look at it. Again, it's will.illinois.edu. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned because there is more coming up as part of the afternoon magazine, and the host for that show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk with a medical doctor who's done extensive research on the effects of the brain's stress response on health. Our guest will be Dr. Esther Sternberg, and she is the author of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and well-being. She'll join us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, September wheat is trading at 515 and a half, up 12 and a quarter. December, 531 and three quarters, up 12 and three quarters. September wheat in Chicago, 477, up 5 and a quarter. December, 503 and a half, up 4 and a quarter. September corn, 321 and a quarter, down 8 and a quarter. December, 326 and three quarters, down 8 and three quarters. March, 340 and a half, down 8 and three quarters. May, 351 and a half, down 7. September beans, 1095 and a quarter, up 15 and a quarter. November, 999, down 8 and a half. January, 10.01 and a half, down 8. March, 9.99 and a quarter, down 7 and 3 quarters. May, 9.90 and 3 quarters, down 11 and 3 quarters. September soybean meal, 355.70, up 9.50. September oil, 36.59, down 52. On to the livestock contracts next. August live cattle, 85.50. That contract is up 32 and a half. October, 89.25. Up 45. August feeder cattle, $100 even, down 10. September, $100, 32 and a half cents, unchanged. October lean hogs, 48.45, up 162. October crude, 74.70, up 33.